79 degrees, rain on the way. Sounds like summer in Minnesota and Wisconsin, doesn't it? It surely does. Here we are. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Stan Turner with you here. And we're always happy to have your company. We strive to bring you shows that that both entertain you and inform you, and hope we have the combination today. I do believe we do. We have a very special friend and guest with us today, and we'll tell you more about that in just a minute. Before we dive into that particular subject, and this one I know you're going to find compelling and in some cases frightening, we should note that this is quite a day in history. World War I could be said to have begun in Sarajevo on this date, June 28th, 1914. 100 years ago today, with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie. The assassination carried out by a young nationalist seeking a greater Serbia. The years that followed, as the war spread across Europe, the Middle East, and Asia, reshaped the modern world in fundamental ways. The war destroyed kings and kaisers, czars and sultans. It demolished empires. It introduced chemical weapons, tanks, and airborne bombing. It brought millions of women into the workforce, hastening their legal right to vote. It gave independence to nations like Ukraine and Poland and the Baltic countries, and created new nations in the Middle East with often arbitrary borders. It brought about major cultural changes, too, including a new understanding of the psychology of war, of shell shock, and of post-traumatic stress. Now, historians still squabble over responsibility for World War I, the Great War, as it was called. Some continue to blame Germany, and others depict a system of rivalries, alliances, and anxieties driven by concerns about the growing weakness of the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires and the growing strength of Germany and Russia that was likely to produce a war in any case, even if there was some other cause. Yes, it's a very complicated and convoluted set of circumstances. What is for sure is millions and millions of combatants and non-combatants died in that horrible conflict, the so-called war to end all wars, and it didn't quite do that, did it? My goodness. I think it behooves us to think about all of this. And yes, the strife in the Middle East at this very moment is in part a very real outgrowth of what happened in World War I, or because of it. Well, here we are, 12:08 right now. Just wanted to remind you of that. This is quite a day in history indeed. And we have quite a day here for the next hour because we're going to be visiting with a very special friend. So I'm going to ask you, folks, where were you? Where were you, Tom, on the 4th of July, 1999?
July 4th. Probably Central Park over in Roseville.
Okay. most of us likely cannot remember, at least in any detail. That certainly applies
that's just
to me.
A guess.
Marlon Brie remembers exactly where he was and in great detail. That happens when you have a near-death experience, as Marlon had on that day nearly 15 years ago. Marlon is a Twin Cities resident who loves boating and sailing and adventure on big bodies of water like Lake Superior. He likes small bodies of water, too, but he gets out there on the big ones. Now, Lake Superior, that's where he was on that fateful day 15 years ago, next Friday, when a monster storm suddenly fell upon him and his 20-foot boat, a sailing boat he made. There they were, out there alone between Isle Royale and Thunder Bay. Lots of others were in peril that day, too, on the 4th of July, 1999. We thought it time to bring Marlon Brie back here to the microphone to take us through that harrowing experience, a storm that began over North Dakota, tore through the woodlands of northern Minnesota, then out into Lake Superior and went on to the nation's east coast. Marlon, my goodness, you ever have nightmares about this? And by the way, welcome back to the microphone. It's good to see you again, my friend.
Thank you so much. Yes, I think about that from time to time. It was a horrendous experience. In fact, I got a call one day from NOAA, the people who have all the satellites and the ships at sea, and said, we'd like to talk with you about that storm. You see, we haven't had an opportunity to talk to too many people who've been out in that storm in a small boat and survived.
And you did, and you're now in the record book. NOAA being the government, National Oceanic and Atmospheric
Agency.
NOAA, right. Not the guy with the ark. No. Although you could have used one that day. What an amazing story. Before we go ahead with your story, your personal account, Marlon Brie, just want to quote, give an overview of that terrible storm that day. And this was written here by Mark Seeley, a good friend of ours here. He's been on the show many times. Mark is a respected climatologist and meteorologist who is based at the University of Minnesota. He writes of that day, it'll be 15 years ago this coming Friday, 4th of July, 1999. He writes, winds of 80 to 100 miles per hour passed over a 600 square mile swath of the Superior National Forest, leveling a quarter million acres of timber valued at $12 to $18 million. 60 people vacationing in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness were injured, and 20 had to be rescued by float plane. Significant wind damage also occurred at Ada, Chisholm, Ely, Hibbing, Moose Lake, and Walker. The exceptionally large and long-lived windstorm began in eastern North Dakota and ended in New England, traveling a distance of 1,300 miles in 22 hours. Notably, it was the most northerly derecho documented in the United States. The tremendous amount of downed timber in the BWCAW elevated the fire danger, of course, and we've had fires since that date in 1999. So that's kind of the overview, Marlon, how did you come to be where you were that day? You love sailing. It's not unusual. You'd be out there on your homemade boat. Persistence is her name.
Yes. Actually, I'd been sailing on Lake Superior for a number of years, but one area in particular appealed to me, and that was the northernmost arc of the Great Lake. That'd be from Thunder Bay over to the Slate Islands, because that was scheduled to someday be the world's largest freshwater park, a conservation area, which it is today. Okay. And I wanted to get in there before government regulations got in.
Yes.
Because it was an interesting little place, including wild little islands that I could sail to, little harbors, something like Bayfield, only on a magnificent scale. They even have an island of silver there that I visited. Actual silver mine down to the bottom of Lake Superior. And on this particular day, I'd waited for several days in Grand Portage, and finally the day cleared. I listened to the NOAA forecast, which says going to be a good day and a hot 4th of July, and so I set sail. And the day had some fog out on the lake, and finally I was in the clear sunshine, and I kept seeing some clouds up on the Sawtooth Mountains. And as I progressed along, suddenly I started hearing a klaxon sounding, and it was the Coast Guard in Thunder Bay warning boaters. And then I heard a message, boat overturned, three boaters in the water. And I was wondering what was going on, but I, you know, started sailing a little faster toward my destination, which was Thompson Cove, a barrier island guarding the mouth of Thunder Bay proper. I was on Lake Superior, and then suddenly this giant simply jumped over the mountains and came at me, and I was in the most horrendous windstorm that I had ever been in. And it's the first few minutes of the storm that is the real killer, I think. This is the wall cloud in which you have downburst and microburst. One meteorologist writing about this in his book said he estimated the speed of the downburst is at 136 miles an hour, which is a phenomenal amount of wind for a little sailboat to stand up to. And as a matter of fact, it didn't. I simply headed off, presenting the stern to the wind so that I could take the entire blast off, you know, the long side of the boat rather than the side. And suddenly I found the boat speeding up, the winds were howling, and getting higher and higher in the shrouds. And this is how I could tell a little bit about the speed of the winds, because they make a sound passing through the shroud, and they sort of sing. And this is the highest pitch singing sound that I'd ever heard in my shrouds. And suddenly, the boat dug in and pitched forward. It was a pitch pole. And I got flung into the cabin down below and hit my head, and I hit my back. And all of a sudden, I knew that my foot was hurting too. And I had gone all the way into the cabin and looked up, and I saw my alarm clock on one side slowly go to the top of the cabin and come back down on the other side. And when I looked at that, just sort of looking up, kind of groggy-like, I saw that the starboard, that's the right side, port light was green. And I thought, my, what a pretty shade of green there.
I bet you did, yeah.
You know, I thought, how did that get green like that? And then I realized it was underwater. The entire side of the boat was underwater. The mast was in the water, and water was slopping up through the centerboard trunk. And I hated that, you know.
I'll bet you did.
And I thought, well, I'd better get up and do something.
I hated
about
that.
Yeah.
That should be the name of your book. I hated that. Yeah. Did the boat capsize? Did it turn turtle all the way?
It went into about a 90-degree capsize, which meant that the mast was in the water, which is a lot for a sailboat. Didn't go all the way down and all the way back up. If that would have happened, and I thought that it was happening at the time, I would probably still be out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you would.
But as it was, you know, I managed to get myself up. Oh, we hit a couple of gusts before that time, and the boat kept going back over and then coming back up and then over and back up. And one time some groceries and things that I had in a sort of milk carton thing fell on top of me, and thought, well, it's time to get up and do something. Then I got up into the cabin, or the cockpit, and the entire boat was on its side. The cockpit was wet, and I looked at some fenders, those heavy rubber white fenders. I put them out because I'd planned to dock in a nearby island, which I never made.
They're like bumpers.
Bumpers. Okay. And I thought they started vibrating, and then they flew up into the sky and went out into the water somewhere. And the water itself was really weird because it had these large haymote-like shapes of hay, only thousands of feet long, sort of writhing back and forth. So I was really in something there.
You were. Marlon Brie, we must say, you are a conscientious sailor, a seasoned sailor. You take no risks. You plan this voyage like you do all your voyages. You had notified the Coast Guard, the proper authorities, where you were, who you were, where you were headed, what your plan, what your route was.
Yeah.
You had all the proper radios on board. Mm-hmm. You had provisions. You even, I think you were dressed in polar fleece. This is the 4th of July, and you're freezing, but you knew it would be cold. So you had all the preparation in place. There's no doubt about it. You are not a reckless sailor by any means. Quite the opposite, a very conscientious one. Yet, this came up and caught you blindsided.
Oh, absolutely. Surprise. It was the worst blowdown of trees in recorded North American history. It was like Paul Bunyan went on a rampage with his axe, somebody said. And all of the stuff that you read from the book pertained to on land, and I was on the water. There was quite an adventure going on there.
Nice. And you have written about this adventure called Wake of the Green Storm. This is all about your harrowing near-death experience is what it really was.
Yeah.
On Lake Superior in this horrendous monster storm of 4th of July, 1999.
Yeah.
Interesting, when you took off from Grand Portage, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And in part of your book here, Wake of the Green Storm, you talk about meeting with a gal named Sue Johnson at the Voyager's Marina there. there. She's a very weather-wise, sailing-wise person, been at the job for a long time. And she has some hesitation. She has some doubts, even though the forecast for 4th of July, which fell on a Sunday that year, 1999, even though it was, you told her, it looks like a good day, nice day on Sunday, she said, that's what they say.
Yes.
She was dubious. She said the weather that year, that spring and summer, had been were having goofy weather. Her word, goofy weather this year. She said the wind is generally out of the west, but this year it's been northeast, and it blows day and night. Normally, she says, it doesn't start blowing until 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. Then it lays off at sunset. Not this year. It's been goofy. And she placed emphasis again on that. So she was doubtful. And you say here in your book, maybe I should have paid closer attention to her subtle reservations about you setting off.
Actually, she tried to reach me when I was on the water through our VHF radio. And the thing is that I just couldn't hear her because I was out of radio range of the United States. I'd crossed into Canadian waters, and I was in contact with the Thunder Bay Coast Guard, which has a number of repeaters there.
Right.
But she said later, after I met her, and she said, I tried to reach you. I said, something was coming up, and I knew it, and I knew you were out there. Mm-hmm. And I said,
I think she knew it in her bones first, didn't she? Or really, viscerally, she knew something.
She grew up on Isle Royale. She's one of the Isle Royale people, one of really new boating. And she said, I tried to reach you and tell you to find a nice island to hide behind.
Yeah. Couldn't get you.
Couldn't get me. And where I was, there were no nice islands to hide behind.
This monster storm of July 4th, 99, it contained a derecho. And we want to explain. We're going to take a break here, come back and explain what derecho is all about. Whoa, you found out firsthand what it's all
killer
about.
Killer storm.
Marlon Brie, a survivor of the monster storm of July 4th, 1999. Hard to believe, Marlon, almost 15 years ago. We'll be right back. We are back here reliving a harrowing, harrowing day and the days that followed in northern Minnesota and out on Lake Superior and points east. It'll be 15 years ago next Friday, 4th of July, 1999, that one of the biggest storms ever to blow through, on record anyway, blow through northern Minnesota and caught so many people on land and on Lake Superior totally unawares. Even those who are very meticulous about their preparations, who stay plugged into radio forecasts, all the rest. Our guest, Marlon Brie, was out there in a home-built 20-foot sailboat called the Persistence. Marlon, a seasoned sailor at the time, the boat was seaworthy, had been to sea many times. As you said, that baby had cut through millions of waves in her time. I think at the time, in 1999, you're 66 years old. Your boat's about 22 years old. Both water and season-tested, no doubt about it. Huh? So no novice out there, neither you nor your boat. You knew what you were doing out there. Yes, you got caught in this. We mentioned that it was a derecho, this kind of a storm that blew this terror across our region that day. Could you please give us a good layman's definition? What is a derecho, please?
Well, at the time I was out there, if somebody had hollered, a derecho is coming, a derecho is coming, I wouldn't know what to do. You know, what is a derecho? Well, now I know all about it. And curiously enough, at the time, very little has been published. Today you can go on the Interweave.
Yeah.
And get it
the
from
Interweave. I like that.
Get it from the Smithsonian and all over the place. Mm. And basically, this is a killer storm. It's it needs certain specifications, and the speed that we were getting on the data buoys, which I checked out later, was 80 miles an hour. And that's not so bad. You know, that'll blow over a few telephone poles and knock over some outhouses up out in the North Woods. But when I went into the woods later, after I got off the lake, just to get a little ahead of the story, I saw not just evidence of a strong storm scraping off the top of the hills, which you would think of straight-line winds, go get the hills, but I saw valleys scooped out, trees smashed down, in the valleys. And I thought, what is going on? And then I started reading, and I found out that it's the wall cloud preceding the derecho that is the real bad one. And that's the first few minutes of the derecho that came and hit me were the really wild ones with the singing in the shrouds.
Yeah.
And that was with, NOAA itself, I'm not sure if it's still on there, said that the average speeds of the downburst and the microburst in the wall cloud preceding a derecho can go up to twice the land speed of the derecho.
My Lord.
That would mean 160 miles an hour. Paul Douglas, in his book Restless Skies, said he estimated the speed of the downburst at 136. And I showed some pictures to some people who study these things, timber fall out in California. He said it was well in excess of 100 miles an hour. Now, that is a monumental amount
of speed. That's hurricane
force.
That's a major hurricane.
That's better than hurricane.
Bigger than hurricane force.
Yeah, yeah.
Derecho, D-E-R-E-C-H-O. In the Spanish, it means direct or straight ahead. And as you have said, it includes downbursts, winds that pop straight down and caught people like you. And as we say, some 60 people were injured. Tom Hsu with us today. I'm glad you're here. Well, always glad you're here, Tom. Normally you don't work this show. Kyle does. But this is serendipitous because it turns out that you have some personal history with this particular storm, July 4th, 1999. Tell us.
Oh, yeah. You asked me early on in the show, where was I? And you're right. I had no idea. I didn't remember. But this conversation, I absolutely brought it all back because I was up about an hour north of Grand Marais over by Flower Lake. It was Golden Eagle Lodge. My family was up there for a vacation. And I remember my mom, she was walking down the trail, coming back to the cabin, and about 90 seconds later, the straight winds just hit and knocked over trees right where she was standing. And these are the big trees that have been there for, you know, hundreds of years.
Right.
These things just knocked everything down. We all had to huddle inside the cabin. The wind was just whipping. It was breaking glass and stuff like that. My grandma walked toward the window. She's a little old.
Sure.
We yanked her back. Edna, get back here.
Yes, no laughing matter, though, at the time.
No.
Your mother, did she escape without injury?
She escaped, and we huddled. And once the storm had passed, the winds had passed by, we walked outside. Our neighbor's cabin had trees that fell on the cabin, smashed their car, you know, straight down onto the van, and basically blocked the entire path out of there for about 3 days. They came by later on that night with buckets that they were giving to everybody, like, sorry, here you go. This is what you got to work with.
Well, you could not know at the time, but not so many miles from you. I mean, not all that far away is this man, Marlon Bree, our guest today, in peril on the sea. You were taking a pounding on land. He's out there all by himself.
It was bad for us on land. Yeah. I cannot even fathom what it would be like on open water.
This is the miracle man right here. Obviously, he's a shipwright. He knows how to build great boats. He knows how to sail. But you somehow did not panic. You're clinging onto the side of your boat at one point, aren't you, Marlon?
Yeah, I was sailing alone. I'm solo sailor. That's my thing. It's a sport. It's not for everyone. Let me put it that way.
Yes.
Not out on Lake Superior.
Make a believer out of me, pal.
Yeah, kids don't try this at home, as they say.
Right.
But when the storm comes, you know, for a minute, when I hit my head going in and was laying there looking at the ceiling and feeling the boat going over and wobbling back and forth, I thought I'd have to start swimming down to get out of the boat because the boat would overturn. And it came very close to that. But when you're alone, you have only yourself as your own resource. And somehow you just sort of suck it up and you start thinking. I play a little game with myself. Something is wrong, Marlon. I'm looking there in the boat. You should be doing something. What is it that you should be doing?
In this moment of duress, you're playing this game in your mind.
Yeah, right? One part of my mind is saying, it's warm here. Just stay low in your burrow. You know, it's the instinctive thing. And the hardest thing I did was to get up out of my little shelter and go back into the cockpit, those winds and the seas, and start fighting the storm. But it's something you just do because you're a solo sailor.
I gotta ask, when it was rocking so badly back and forth, did you have any kind of, like, run to the opposite direction to try to push the boat back? Just that little extra force to keep it from tipping?
Initially, I was down in the cabin on the low end, and things were falling on me, and water was slopping in, and I really didn't do anything except, you know, survive and sort of shake my head because I hit my head. But I finally got myself up into the cockpit, and it was all wet, and the boat was still on its side in these wild winds and not coming up. And so I finally decided I was going to have to wrestle with the storm, and so I simply threw myself over the high side, hanging onto the winch and leaning out. And that didn't help at all, let me tell you.
It was a good thought.
Marlon, how did you get out of this horror story? How did it happen?
Eventually, what happened was the wall cloud passed, and then I was faced with only 80-mile-an-hour winds.
Only 80, okay. All relative.
All right. Well, you know, hey, you know. And all of a sudden, the boat came back up. And the rudder came back out of the water, and I was on the outboard at that time, and the propeller came into the water, and we speeded off into the middle of Lake Superior. And we just ran like that because that was all we could do. And then finally, when the winds went down, I managed to turn the boat and headed back to a little spit of land, and I just held the boat there under full throttle, in the lee of that land until it looked like I could make a dash for it. But it was a nasty business out there, and it's starting to rain, and I was in my long underwear and my fleece and my Taslin boating jacket with a fleece inside, and I was freezing.
You're insulated but freezing.
I was in some state of hyperthermia because I was shaking so bad I couldn't stop shaking.
It's interesting how you describe you and your boat. We did this and we did that. It's you and your friend who you know is your only vehicle literally for survival if you treat it right, if things go right.
Yes.
But you didn't panic. You didn't panic. You thought through the thing.
Too busy to panic.
Well, that's true. So you got out. And you've written about this in the book again. And can we still get a copy of this? The Wake of the Green Storm. Marlon Bree. It's B-R-E-E, the last name. First name spelled M-A-R-L-I-N. Marlon Bree.
Yes, it's out there and many copies. As a matter of fact, it's just come out as a new audio book from New Rivers Press.
Who's the reader? Would that be me? No, I didn't do that. I wish I would.
You
I wish I would
have. But it was, you know.
I would have been frightened to read it. I would have panicked. No, so it's available as an audio book now.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
As well as print and e-book and all that stuff.
Yeah. You have a number of other books, too. Are they going on to audio books, too?
Do you know? Teeth of the Northeaster is an audio book, and that's put out by, again, New Rivers Press. Mm-hmm. It's about a 7-hour downloadable thing you can play on your radio or whatever, and it's narrated by the guy who's the narrator for Dangerous Catch, the Discovery show program, you know.
Okay.
Most Dangerous Catch series, very famous.
Deadliest Catch.
Thank you. Deadliest Catch. Yeah.
When it comes to deadly stuff, he has no equal right there.
Right. It's interesting listening to a professional narrator read your words, which are really designed for the print page, and a good narrator can really make it sing.
This is true, but so can a good writer. And I wanted to say, Marlon, because I believe this thoroughly, entirely, and profoundly, our late common friend, Don Boxmeyer, who was a wonderful writer, columnist for the St. Paul newspapers, he was a friend of yours.
Yes.
Of course, he was like a brother to me. You both have the same ability to write in a way that I always said about Don Boxmeyer and about your writing. You don't read your stories so much as you see them in your mind. It's a video. It's a visual. And that's the highest form of writing, I think, where people are not conscious of reading the written word, but they're seeing what you're talking about. You do that. You have that capacity, as Don did. So that's a lovely thing. And to hear a professional narrator reading your words, too, that has to be a thrill.
Yes, it is.
For you and for the person listening. Terrific.
But I seem to get into it pretty good.
Yeah. This is great. You've got other books, but first let's do kind of a segue here. We'll take a break, but let's set up the stage here. Robert Redford did a movie, and I think 2013.
Solo Sailor.
Last year. Whoa. Solo Sailor. Yes. Name of the movie, folks. Don't know if many of you have seen it or heard about it. All is Lost is the name of it. Here's a man, a sailor, portrayed by Robert Redford, all alone out there on a larger boat than you had, out in the Indian Ocean, and he runs afoul. He comes a cropper of some bad stuff. And Tom, can we hear a little of the music from that? This is from the soundtrack. All is Lost. It sounds menacing, doesn't it? And indeed, it should sound menacing.
Whoa.
Marlon, the overview of the story. Then we'll take a break and come back and fill it out. Go ahead.
Robert Redford is a solo sailor on a Cal 39 sailboat. And the story opens with him saying 26, or about 19 of the 26 words that he in total offers in the entire movie. It's all about him and his adventures. And he runs into something in the water. He fights the capsized boat and some of the most remarkable footage I've ever seen. And then finally, he has to go to a life raft, all in the Indian Ocean and all by himself. It's a remarkable movie.
I'll bet it kind of freaked you out at times, didn't it?
It did.
Considering
it was,
your experience in the Green Storm.
It was a visceral movie for me. It simply got to me, and I almost started perspiring right there in that theater seat. Yes.
How about that music we just heard? Isn't that amazing stuff?
Wow. Oh.
Marlon Brie, super sailor who sometimes comes eye to eye with really big danger, but fortunately survives. We're talking about the big storm of July 4th, 1999, and other related topics. We'll tell you more about All Is Lost, the Redford film, and some other things, Marlon, that you're up to in just a minute. Please stay with us. Stan Turner Show. We'll jump right back in here. Boy, this hour, Marlon Brie, where is it going? Like a storm blowing it away, isn't it, huh? It's going fast here. Thank you so much for being here. Marlon Brie, a survivor of the Green Storm, the massive blowdown in northern Minnesota 15 years ago, next Friday, July 4th, 1999. There's Marlon out there in a 20-foot homemade sailboat out there on Lake Superior, got caught unawares, blindsided by this massive storm. He survived. He survived by pluck, by courage, by everything at his resources, at his command. And there must have been a higher force helping you out that day, too, Marlon. You never know. Huh?
I felt it.
Yep,
I felt it.
I believe you did. And we're talking about now related topic. See, a movie of
Solo
recent
Sailor,
of recent vintage, 2013. All Is Lost, starring Robert Redford, who utters 26 words of dialogue in the entire hour and a half movie.
Yeah, and he's the only person in the movie. He carries it himself.
And here's a guy in peril on the sea.
Yeah.
He is in a larger boat than you had, but nevertheless badly damaged vessel.
Yes.
And he's out there all by himself, left to his own devices.
Yes, off the Indian Ocean, sailing alone. Robert Redford in his 39-foot Cal runs into a container. And this holds his boat, and one of the things we see opening up is the water rushing in, and Robert Redford, who has fallen inside his boat, is just waking up to see water slowly coming up the cabin, so just like I saw it coming in the centerboard trunk. And the story follows what he did to save himself and his boat in the most dire of circumstances. And I saw it, at one of the local theaters, 70-foot wide screen, Dolby surround sound, and when the storm came on and the lightning.
And you're there, aren't you?
Listen, I was in one of those plush seats, recliner, and I was sitting up and practically shaking.
Amazing. You, of all people who knows this, the ups and downs,
it got to me. It was a splendid movie. And it's just now coming out, on the satellite things.
I have to get it. You've reviewed it for a publication, The Ensign, which is kind of an in-house publication for sailors. But you gave it generally a positive review.
Yes. Yes, you know? As a movie. Yes.
Do we want as a brilliant movie? I know there's some technical flaws in it, sailors like you would know and spot. Yeah. But basically, overall, a heck of a story, well told and beautifully acted.
Yes.
The emotions, just amazing.
I think it's one of the most significant small boat movies to come out of Hollywood ever. And Robert Redford, who got a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival for his role, was simply superb. And the technology there was absolutely amazing. They used a Horizon tank in Baja, California to film it. This is what they used on the Titanic.
I thought so, yes.
And what they did was they had not one Cal 39s, but they had three Cal.
What does Cal mean? What is a Cal?
A Cal is simply the name of a boat that was a really hot racer cruiser on the West Coast, California, 39-foot long.
Okay.
It's, my boat is 20. This is 39, but 39 in boat terms, a whole different boat. But he was sailing alone in 39-foot, very good. I write for a magazine called Cruising World, and people actually are out there sailing around the world by themselves. 39 is a good size.
Wow.
Anyway, what they did was take this three boats and had some hydraulic rams inside the Horizon tank and Robert Redford inside the boats, and they actually capsized it with him inside. Storms come up. You know, they could rock the boat. It was just an absolutely amazing experience. Yeah.
You were reliving, weren't you, that horrible day, huh? You, in many ways, you
yes.
were. The parallels
are amazing. Yes.
Marlon, we should say that you are the author of a forthcoming book, your first novel.
Yes.
Guess what? About sailing, about a lone sailor, I think. Is that right? This is Dead on the Wind is the title. We have a mock-up here or an early look at the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Skull and crossbones, menacing clouds, and see a small little sailboat on the horizon.
Heading into the distance, yes.
Right. By the way, we're not going to do a spoiler on All Is Lost. We'll have to let the listener go watch and see how it ends, okay?
Yeah.
It's pretty grim. You wonder. I'm not going to tell you how it ends because you might be surprised. Anyway, Dead on the Wind, your forthcoming novel. Tell
about
us about this.
Solo sailors again. I seem to be in a rut here. You know?
I started
my
first
book was Alone Against the Atlantic, which I did with Jerry Spieth.
Mm-hmm.
Solo sailor, white bear, crossing the Atlantic.
10-foot boat.
10-foot boat, again crossing the Pacific in his 10-foot boat. And I was the information officer stateside on that boat. Wonderful voyage. Then I got into my own boats and then all the nonfiction and now Dead on the Wind. One day at the Minnesota boat show, Minneapolis boat show, I met up with a guy by the name of Mike Plant.
Oh, yes.
Mike Plant is a former Minnetonka sailor, racer, and one day he saw a film on the Vendée Globe race. And the Vendée Globe race is billed as the world's toughest sailboat race because all Mike wanted to do was build a 60-foot boat, which he would sail nonstop on the wind around the globe.
All he wanted to do, you say. All he wanted to do. Yes. That's a mighty endeavor, isn't it?
Well, a 60-foot boat is just
a phenomenal
thing. And then race it nonstop, unassisted, all alone, solo. Dead on the Wind, working with Mike, we were going to do a book together until he was killed on the North Atlantic, sailing his new boat, Coyote, to enter the Vendée Globe a number of years ago. By the way, the Vendée Globe will run again in 2016.
A yachting race or a sailboat race.
Yeah, sailboat race, 60-foot, all alone, nonstop, around the world, unassisted, solo. Anyway, Dead on the Wind is the story of a mysterious happening in such a race in which racers are going around the world in various ports of call, and some of them are dying very mysteriously. And this is the premise for this thriller mystery book. And I think if you like boating, this will be something you really would like to
and
see.
And mysteries and thrillers,
and
too.
Exotic and
all
storms
wow.
and all that sort of
Written
thing.
Written by you, Dead on the Wind, Marlon Brie. And when will we be able to buy this novel,
Spring
Marlon?
Next year. Which means that I'm just now doing my final research on the manuscript. I've got a guy in Australia who is going out solo in the area that I described, the Tasman Sea,
yes.
and he's going to read it. I've got a tugboat captain who is now in Seattle, just fixed his sinking trawler, and his wife was reading it and texting me just yesterday, and I've got an ocean racer in San Diego, which is another port that the Dead on the Wind takes place.
So they're, in a sense, taking this out for a test run to see how
your
novel stacks
PDF
up.
And they're reading it, and they say, well, no, if you put your port to helm, you should go like that. And this is something you really need to watch, and I'm very careful of, and I need to get other inputs on it. It's a novel, it's fiction, and you can't write nonfiction and write a novel at the same time. I tried. It just doesn't work.
Tom and I will read it, too, and we'll give you all the pointers you need, Marlon.
All right.
Yeah,
good
sure.
Deal.
Okay. Right. Marlon Brie, if you have a home port, I think it would be or was White Bear Lake.
Yeah.
You live in the area.
Yeah.
You're a Minnesota boy.
Sure.
And, by the way, Marlon worked for the Star Tribune for many years before all of this came to pass.
Put
together that Sunday magazine.
I was the editor of the
magazine.
You
were the editor. You were, as we've already said, a fine writer indeed. So you've got the chops. Both on land and on the sea. Let's talk about White Bear Lake. This is a subject of unending mystery and speculation. Why is that lake, a favorite lake in the Twin Cities area in Minnesota, why is it falling? The level's been, what is it, down 6 feet over recent years?
Yeah.
You used to tie up your boat there.
Oh, listen, Jerry Spies tested his boat there before he went into the Atlantic. I tested my boat there before I went up onto Lake Superior, and it's a beautiful, historic, memorable lake, and it's fallen on terrible
times. What's happened? Why is the water level going
down? Well, the water level, last I heard, was down about 6 feet, but now up a couple of inches because of the storm. And I've talked with a number of people, and including DNR people, and they say that it's the aquifers that feed the lake that are being used by communities and particular industry that are sucking up all of the water that would be normally going
feeding
into White Bear.
Yeah. The aquifers are like underground rivers or streams, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's it. That's the reason.
Yeah, for a while they thought there was a hole in the lake and it was falling out. Or
can this be stopped?
You know,
can these communities, can these industries stop?
I think
what they're doing?
I think we're going to have to balance off our natural resources and our conservation effort with community and industrial needs. And in
we
the
need our industries, we know that.
Yeah,
communities need certain resources, too.
And White Bear, which is, you know, grown up on this beautiful lake, is now – I just drove by it on my way in. And the water is up more than it was. It used to go out to the end of the dock and still not hit the water.
Right.
Now the water is up some, but the weeds have grown so much that it's...
You can't sail on that stuff, can you? You can't go boating.
I have friends who still put their boats in the lake, but they said, well, we go out on the boat and we sort of rock around a little bit. If you want to sail, you know, you've got to fight your way out of slip through the weeds and the prop gets, you know, gummed up with all of the weeds. And then you find a patch of water and then you can go sailing.
Oh, boy. Yeah, with five square feet of water. Where are you tying up Persistence these days?
Well, I'm just not launching it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
What a shame. What a shame.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a fixture out there, you and your boat.
Yeah, that
along
was,
with many others.
That was a thing. It was a thing, yeah.
Marlon Brie, when you're on the show here, we always want to ask you about a subject that is of unending fascination, and that is what we often call our Titanic story, and that is the sinking of the big ore freighter Edmund Fitzgerald, November 10th, 1975. She had left on a balmy Indian summer day from the docks at Superior, Wisconsin, and cruise toward, you know, up lake and then or down lake, actually, and still in Lake Superior off Whitefish Bay, I think, and that would be the eastern reaches of the Big Lake. And she came to grief there. And, of course, as you've written about this, in fact, many places, not the least of which is in your book called Broken Seas.
Oh, yes, yes.
A marvelous account. And you've also told us what it must have been like for the crewmen experiencing this horror from the inside of the ship. It's hair-raising, it really is. Okay, coming around to this now, anything new on the sinking of the Fitzgerald? Has any information come to light
in recent
times?
It's a subject of unending fascination, and it's now, in terms of national recognition, second only to the sinking of the Titanic in interest. And it's there have been people down there looking for the, you know, what they can find out. I've talked with some of them. I've been on the route that she went, including that point in Whitefish Bay. And they're always looking for new things pertaining to the sinking. But it's generally agreed now, although not all accept this, that she came across a point that was uncharted, and she had no depth sounder because the R-boats didn't use them in those days, and simply holed out. And the evidence for this is that at the time she made a contact with a boat following her, she was doing fine. She went through the six-fathom shoals area.
This is during a raging storm.
During a raging storm, a terrible storm, yeah. And immediately passing through that area, she then radioed back to the accompanying ore boat 3 or 4 miles behind her, which had her on the radar, saying, we have fence rail down, we have a list, and the boat radioed Fitzgerald, do you have your pumps on? And Fitzgerald captain said, yes, all of them. This indicates to me that something calamitous happened passing through that six-fathom shoal. Now, it wasn't hatch covers that sank her. It wasn't a number of other factors that others have put up. It had to be, to me, the shoal of the boat.
She bottomed out. She hit bottom in a very shallow area. Yeah. Is that right? Is that what it was? And tore the bottom out.
Yeah, from that point, she was a slowly sinking ship. She had bulkheads, she had pumps, you know, just could not keep up with it.
She had a seasoned captain, McSorley.
McSorley, yeah.
I think this was his last commercial run of his career, wasn't
it? Yeah, he was pushing it pretty hard.
He always did. He had a reputation for pushing those boats.
And he just cut in a little too closely to that area. If you go up to Duluth and you see the Irwin, the large warship, you can just, in the chart room, you'll see a chart, and you'll see a red dot where the six-fathom shoal is, an old chart. And that says, stay out of this area. Yeah.
Was this chart made before the Fitzgerald went down?
Yes, yes.
So it was known.
I sailed that area. I've talked with waterfront people. I've tied up alongside tugboats, and they say, yeah, we know about that. People have bottomed out there before, meaning they've hit the bottom, but they haven't sunk the boat, you know. Right. They've dented their bottom. And actually, one day I was at in Chicago talking with some people on board a large boat, and they said, yeah, there's the divers that were down on that reef. And so I talked to the divers, and I said, were you down on the reef? He said, well, we might have been. And I said,
being coy with you.
Because millions of dollars are
insurance
and all of that. And I said, well, did you see anything? And he said, well, no. I said, if a boat the size of the Fitzgerald went through there, would there be any evidence left? And I said, yeah, you'd see tailings, you'd see strips of metal, you see bright spots on the reef where they were cut away.
Did they see those things, Marlon?
Well, that was my very next question. I said, is that what you observed? And he said, I really wish I could tell you more.
To be continued in the insurance investigation. Yeah. Marlon Bree, always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much, my friend. I'm so happy in so many ways you survived that horrible day almost 15 years ago up there. Boy, what a sailor you are. Huh? Wow. Like you say, folks, don't try this at home. Solo sailing on Lake Superior. He once described Lake Superior as a beautiful lady who will turn on you and kill you. Huh?
Yeah.
She's done that, hasn't she? It is a beautiful place. Love to look at her. I don't want to go sailing on her. Marlon, thank you so much. Marlon Bree, that's it. B-R-E-E. You can find his books out there. You're in for a real treat. A great writer, and the man writes from experience. Thank you. Look for his forthcoming novel, Dead on the Wind, next year. Marlon, thanks. Come back soon, will you?
Thank you.
Stan Turner here. Thank you, Tombo. And we'll see you all with the All Request Show on Monday at noon. Bye-bye.